Listen, Tom, I know that people are worried about Oliver Ekman-Larsson later on, and I understand the consternation a little bit, but you get him, and you also get Connor Garland. Like, it's a massive upgrade in talent right now.
Well, the key there is Garland, right? Like, the key there is Garland, who's one of the best-kept secrets in hockey, but for me, he's a top-line caliber talent. And that gives the Canucks a lethal top six, which is such a key ingredient for this club that traditionally, or at least over the past few years, has been pretty permissive defensively. You need to be able to throw a fastball offensively with your young guns, plus JT Miller, plus Bo Horvat, that other teams struggle to hit. And we saw when they had Toffoli in the lineup that makes them a pretty imposing group overall. They didn't really have that last season. Like, the top six just wasn't the same level of strength, and partly that was because, you know, of how the club started and some funky vibes around the team. But I do think Garland's the part coming back in that deal that's likely to have a bigger impact in terms of upgrading Vancouver for next season. With Oliver Ekman-Larsson, I'm really curious to see how he performs, because his game has certainly not been elite since he was in his mid-20s, frankly. And last year in particular, his effectiveness really fell off. Was that a one-year mirage, the result of a toxic environment all told in Arizona, especially for a player who they got so close to trading during the offseason of 2020, October of 2020? Or is there something more concerning there in his game? You know, for me, with the size of the liability that the Canucks have taken on, right? And effectively, the Canucks were able to give up futures, $12 million worth of, like, you know, press box caliber fourth line contributors, right? In exchange for taking back a $44 million liability in Ekman-Larsson. When a team's that willing, that thirsty to move a deal, I think that speaks volumes. And, you know, it's really essential for the Canucks. Like, this has to work. And it doesn't just have to work next season. It has to work for a few years beyond it, because as it stands, the Canucks have hitched their wagon to a 30-year-old defender who's been declining for a while, really struggled a year ago, and represents $7.26 million of their cap space through 2027. And gentlemen, like, Quinn Hughes is going to be 28, and Elias Pettersson is going to be 29 when Oliver Ekman-Larsson expires. So it's a big bet. They believe that he can be, if not a top-pair caliber defender still, at least a top-four guy. At least an upgrade on Alex Edler. They better be right.
Thomas Drance joining us, talking all things at Vancouver Canucks. With the addition of Dickinson, does that eliminate JT Miller from playing center?
No, I don't think it does. I think they like the idea of Dickinson on the wing, potentially. I also think they like the idea of JT Miller playing center. And most importantly, JT Miller likes the idea of JT Miller playing center. And so, you know, I'm really curious to see how they deploy things. The good news is that in Sutter, Brandon Sutter, who's their, you know, ostensibly their fourth line center, but whose game plays pretty well on the wing. I mean, he's a 6'3" guy. He's pretty intelligent, and he's a much better shooter than he is distributor. Like, he's good along the wall. Dickinson can play at center or along the wall. He's not really going to play center, for example, for you on the PK. At least I don't think they'll use him there. So, you know, there's some versatility there. JT Miller is a winger who can, you know, is a perfect fit for Elias Pettersson. I mean, that's one thing that needs to be noted. Like, Pettersson and Miller are more than the sum of their parts together, and one benefit of it is you take a guy who's like a 45% face-off winner in Pettersson and give him a left wing who wins 60% of his draws. I mean, there's a lot of benefit there, right? Not to mention the way that they, you know, find the soft areas and cycle together and attack off the rush together and forecheck together. When those two are on, I just think that partnership's really valuable. So while I think the Canucks will be loath to separate them, the fact that you've got a guy in Sutter who can move to the wing, a guy in Dickinson who can move to the wing, and a winger in Miller who can move to the center gives you a ton of weird options depending on how you want to attack certain matchups. I mean, could the Canucks go, you know, Pettersson, Horvat, Miller, Dickinson down the center? I mean, against some opponents, you'd think that that would make you pretty imposing, especially if they get some value out of, you know, some of their fringe NHL guys, which they loaded up on in Abbotsford. If you can get something out of a Phil DiGiuseppe, if you can get something out of a Justin Bailey, if rookie Vasily Podkolzin coming over to Russia, you know, proves that he can be a middle six piece on day one, then, you know, you've got all sorts of crazy options to throw curveballs at, you know, opposing lineups. And throwing curveballs is kind of a Travis Green specialty, right? Like, that plays well into his hands, I think. I think he'll have a field day with those options, and I think that's an underrated area in which the Canucks are improved, that ability to mix and match and sort of play two opponents. You know, I don't think you want to do that too often, right? You still want to play your game, but the ability to do it in a pinch, especially, you know, with some of the teams and teams like L.A. that are coming at you with Deneau and Kopitar, or teams like Edmonton in the event that they separate Dreisaitl and McDavid. You know, I think there's a different ability to counter that, to fatten or thin your lineup out depending on what you need. You know, I think that makes them better too, and is an important factor to keep in mind as you go into watching some of these Canucks games next season. You may see a pretty different team night to night.
Thomas Durance joins us from The Athletic in Vancouver discussing the Canucks. Tom, you mentioned the four groups. What about on the back end? Oliver Ekman-Larsson comes in. Edler is out. Who's Hughes going to play with?
I would expect Hughes to play with Hamonic. Hamonic spent about 80% of his even strength ice time with Hughes last season. They got off to a bit of a funky start, which wasn't a huge surprise because Hamonic hadn't played in like 15 months, right? He opted out of the bubble. He was injured before the pause. He had an excruciatingly long layoff. Then 8 games in, he got injured. Comes back, they had like a good month, and then there's the COVID outbreak. Both of them appeared on the protocol list, and I don't know that you can take a ton of like analytical or evaluative value from the last 10 or so games that the Canucks played last season, right? Like, I'm kind of throwing that in the bin. I have no idea how severe some guys' symptoms were versus others. And the team was so shorthanded throughout it. Not to mention playing 4 games after the playoffs had already started. I'm not dinging anyone for struggling in those games, nor am I applauding anyone for bringing it beyond, you know, the heart shown. So, the Canucks are effectively betting that there's like a middle 12 to 15 games that Hamonic and Hughes looked really good together in. That's like the true measure of that pair. And I expect Pullman, you know, who is not my cup of tea, but Tucker Pullman, of course, they signed at 4 years times $2.5 million, a deal that gave a lot of people around this league sticker shock. And, you know, I suspect that he's going to be the guy who plays with Oliver Ekman-Larsson. One thing about Pullman, again, not necessarily my cup of tea, but he does move really well for a large man, right? I mean, there's no question about that. I think with where Oliver Ekman-Larsson's game's at this point, you know, he's probably going to need to play toughs, especially with the likelihood that the left side of Vancouver's D rolls, you know, Quinn Hughes and maybe rookie Jack Rathbone or Brad Hunt, but either way, not another guy that you want playing toughs. So it's going to be Ekman-Larsson. I'd expect him to favor a guy like Pullman in that role, especially with how he paired with Morrissey last season in Winnipeg. And so I'm expecting that to be a pair. I think the club's hoping that, you know, Pullman's mobility can help out, for Ekman-Larsson at this stage of his career. And that sort of leaves you a third pair that's going to be Tyler Myers. He won't play third pair minutes, but he'll take line rushes third. And, you know, one of the lefties, and that could be Olio Levy, still unsigned. He's an RFA. It could be Jack Rathbone. He's widely seen as the, leading contender, the pack leader for that spot in Vancouver. But he also could be better. He hasn't played in the AHL in 5 years, and the last time he did, he was the AHL's leading scorer, and not just for defensemen. He's an NHL-caliber player, and obviously you guys are familiar with him, too, in Edmonton. That was before he was an NHL mainstay. And so we'll see sort of how that shakes out at camp. But there's definitely going to be a fair bit of competition, especially because the Canucks splashed a ton of money out on like the quad A sort of, taxi squad level players, really fleshing out an Abbotsford American Hockey League team that's coming local for the first time in the franchise's history.
Bringing on the Vancouver Canucks with the Athletics Canuck reporter Thomas Strantz. And Thomas, it's clear that Demko is their guy. They moved out Holtby, then they got Halak in there. So, you know, how many games would you expect to see Demko playing as compared to the, you know, pretty veteran Halak at, what is he? I think he's 35.
It's 36. And so 36. They've signed him to a deal, and it's a one-year deal, $1.5 million cap hit, but a $1.5 million performance bonus, too. So he only counts against the Canucks cap at 1.5, but should he hit his bonus, they'll roll over a $1.5 million overage into next season, more than likely, unless they shed a ton of space and trade Michael Ferland's contract. Ferland, of course, effectively retired and on LTI. Seems like a tall order, right? Seems like they're prepared to roll over $1.5 million. And the benchmarks that he has to hit, gentlemen, to earn his bonuses are just appear in 10 games. He's guaranteed to do that. The Canucks have 10 back-to-backs and post the same percentage above .905. Pretty likely at this point, especially for a goaltender with Halak's consistency over the past decade, although he did have, you know, one of his worst seasons since the lockout, the 2013 lockout anyway, last year behind a Boston defense that, let's be honest, gentlemen, very much more sturdy than what we've typically seen out of the Canucks. So we'll see how Halak fits, but I would expect him to play. You know, I don't think you want Demko to play more than 60 games. I mean, this is a guy who's been a starter at every level. So you don't want to overstate the fact that he's never been a day one starter in the NHL before. But I also think you do have to know that, you know, being leaned on to run and roll with this type of workload and sustain it over a seven-month period at the NHL level is something we haven't seen from him. And, you know, a goalie with that kind of profile, I mean, I think you'd want him to play, what, somewhere between 55 and 62, right? So they're going to need games out of Halak, and they're going to need pretty good games, especially in a Pacific division. You know, they have ambitions of being, you know, a surefire playoff team. It's not about competing for the playoffs after the moves they've made. It's about being a surefire playoff team. And if you're going to be that in a Pacific division that's shaping up to be, you know, something of a knife fight, I think, at least beneath Vegas. You know, maybe Edmonton's in second by a nose or two, but, you know, those third and fourth spots look to be hotly contested between, you know, four teams, in my view, that have a credible chance, a credible claim at being up there. You're going to need wins out of your backup. You're probably going to need 12 to 13 wins out of your backup. So there's going to be some pressure on Halak to perform, and, you know, he's got some bonuses tied to doing so.
Tom, one last one. What do you make of so many changes off the ice in the business side for the Vancouver Canucks? Is there something going on there with ownership that it's kind of rare to see, you know, presidents shipped in and out that quickly?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something there for sure, but it's also part and parcel with an organization that, you know, really tightened its belt last season, right? After the bubble experience, the Canucks cut, you know, almost a quarter of their payroll in terms of player personnel spend, and it showed on the ice. They also cut business side staff massively, like really went down to a rump of key executives, a skeleton staff, as it were. And, you know, I think the seams showed all over the place in terms of a season that Travis Green recently described as miserable, and which Canucks owner Francesco Aquilini described as dismal at one point during the season. And so, you know, when you look at all of those changes and then look at what's happened since, I mean, there are 17 players that were either on the Canucks roster, taxi squad, or were hitting their books, whether by, you know, injured reserve or, you know, in the case of a guy like Sven Berchi in the minors, but still had a cap hit that applied at the NHL level. 17 players on the last day of the season who fit that description have since moved on. That level of wholesale change, when you've got guys like Nate Schmidt waving to go to Winnipeg, when you've got guys like Alex Edler who were completely resistant to the idea that they'd ever leave Vancouver, right? Repeatedly refused to waive his no trade or no move clauses at deadlines for, you know, it feels like the better part of a decade. It was the never ending story in this market.
Yeah.
You know, when those guys are departing and letting you know in advance, right? I mean, it's not like Edler departed because they made the OEL trade. Edler had informed them of his intentions several days out from them making that deal. You know, when all of those combination of factors sort of are at play and all playing out at the same time, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, there was an awful lot going on behind the scenes, that it didn't work out,
that, you know, this club needed a fundamental culture reset and probably needed to show from ownership on down a level of renewed commitment to the on-ice product and to the organization itself. And within the environment that I'm just describing, does wholesale change of business leadership surprise you at all? It certainly wasn't a fun place to be over the course of the past 12 months, gentlemen.
Tom, always good to catch up with you, my man. We appreciate
likewise,
it. And good luck. Baby Stash says, keep up your 7 articles a week. So good luck with that.
Yeah, I'll take a vacation when Frank Saravalli does. Tell him that.
Awesome. Cheers. Thanks, Tom.